from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Outrage this week over the six-month jail sentence handed down to the Stanford freshman found guilty of sexual assault. The victim's long, heart-wrenching statement has gone viral. Jessica Valenti, a leading voice of contemporary feminism, calls that statement, quote, a damning indictment of a culture that bends over backwards to humanize rapists while demonizing their victims. This hour on Point, Jessica Valenti is with us. Her new memoir is Sex Object. We're looking at men, women, victimhood, feminism, and the Stanford case. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your verdict on the Stanford sentence on where we've come on rape, sexual assault, sexual objectification, and that incredible statement from the young woman assaulted there behind the dumpster? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. That 12, 13-page statement has turned the heads and ears and minds of the entire country. On CNN's Legal View on Monday, host Ashley Banfield read the entire thing. Took more than a half an hour. Written by the woman who was raped by Brock Turner, the former Stanford swimmer. We're going to hear a bunch of that in this hour. You may have read it already. Many, many have here. The victim explains how she felt after the assault when she was taking a shower.
I stood there examining my body beneath the stream of water, and I decided I don't want my body anymore. I was terrified of it. I didn't know what had been in it. If it had been contaminated, who had touched it? I wanted to take off my body like a jacket and leave it at the hospital with everything else.
Page after page of excruciating, eloquent testimony from the victim. Here she describes the moment that she discovered the details of her own rape by reading about it online.
He had taken off my underwear. His fingers had been inside of me. I don't even know this person. I still don't know this person. When I read about me like this, I said, this can't be me. I read that according to him, I liked it. I liked it. Again, I do not have words for these feelings.
From the statement of the victim in the Stanford rape case read there by Ashley Banfield on CNN. Jessica Valenti joins us in just a moment. But first, joining me from New York is Emma O'Connor. She's a news reporter for BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed put that statement up. Millions of people have read it there. She's been covering the Stanford case. Emma O'Connor, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Remind us just what a phenomenon this has turned into at BuzzFeed, the long statement by this young woman.
It's really incredible. It's actually been one of the most read things we've published in the past year. Before that, it was as you know, BuzzFeed publishes a wide variety of different subjects. So the one before this was about a trick of the eye called The Dress. It was a phenomenon. And since then, this has been the most popular thing on our site, which is really incredible.
What are the latest developments in this case? I understand she's got a statement out. I understand that Brock Turner, the now convicted and sentenced to a six-month jail sentence, has a statement of his own out today. What's he saying?
I think he's saying the same things that he was saying before, essentially. I think that he's readdressing what he had said in court about his regret about drinking. He's really been focusing this toward drinking, which she addresses in her statement. He essentially is just reiterating what he had said before in a way, but now in the new context of this widespread outrage toward him.
I have to say, reading quickly from what he's put out today, I don't see a whole lot of evolution. He says, I want to demolish, this is Brock Turner, I want to demolish the assumption that drinking and partying are what make up a college lifestyle. I made a mistake. I drank too much and my decisions hurt someone, but I never meant to intentionally hurt, I guess the name is redacted here. Oh, okay. My poor decision-making, excessive drinking hurt someone that night, and I wish I could take it all back. I never meant to intentionally hurt, but what do you think he was doing?
Yeah, I mean, see, exactly. Like he's turning it back to the drinking. That's been his defense from the beginning. So I think that he's just saying that he didn't do it. It was some different version of him that was made to do this by drinking. And that's just been his constant defense.
There's been a petition signed by lots of Stanford students, professors, alumni, calling for a longer sentence here. Is there any sign that the judge may move on his six-month sentence, or is that it?
No, that seems like it. It's very rare for any judges to go back on their sentence. It's also very rare for judges to be recalled. I know there's been a lot of petitions signed by hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, asking for this judge to be recalled, but that just doesn't seem like it's going to be a possibility. And he was actually reelected today as he was running unopposed.
Wow. So that's done as well. What stands out to you about this case, Emma?
I think her letter, it's so rare that we get to hear so extensively from the victim in these cases. As she has remained anonymous, I think a lot of victims are afraid of putting themselves in the spotlight. She went forward with her deepest, most intimate feelings as a victim and as somebody who went through this incredibly difficult case for over a year. And I think people could really identify with that and just appreciated her very beautiful and honest writing in a way that honestly was surprising to me, the level that people have connected with this. But I've received hundreds of emails and tweets from people saying that they cried while reading it and thanking us for putting it out. So it's really been amazing.
How many have read it, clicked into it now?
I think it's about 10 million, something like that.
That is a lot of attention.
That's just on the site. So if people read it on their phones and elsewhere, it doesn't register. So it's more.
So we're talking millions and millions and millions reading it. BuzzFeed.
Yeah, 11 million, more than 11 million.
11 million. Emma O'Connor is a news reporter for BuzzFeed. Emma, thank you for joining us for a minute today.
Thanks, Tom.
Let's hear just a little more from that incredible statement. This, again, is CNN's Ashley Banfield reading, written by the woman who was raped by the Stanford swimmer Brock Turner. The victim explains, she says, why being drunk is not a justification for the assault.
You said, being drunk, I just couldn't make the best decisions and neither could she. Having too much to drink was an amateur mistake that I admit to, but it is not criminal. We were both drunk. The difference is that I did not take off your pants and underwear, touch you inappropriately, and run away. That's the difference. You said I stupidly thought it was okay for me to do what everyone around me was doing, which was drinking. I was wrong. Again, you were not wrong for drinking. Everyone around you was not sexually assaulting me. Lastly, you said I want to show people that one night of drinking can ruin a life. Ruin a life? One life? Yours? You forgot about mine. Let me rephrase for you. I want to show people that one night of drinking can ruin two lives, you and me. You are the cause. I am the effect.
You can read the entire letter, the entire statement, at our website, onpointradio.org. Joining me now in the studio is Jessica Valenti, feminist author, founder of the blog feministing.com. Her column in The Guardian is headlined, recent headline, is "To Brock Turner's Victim, Know This, We Are With You." You can link to that as well, and to the victim's statement. Jessica Valenti's new memoir is titled Sex Object. It's her personal story, the toll that sexual objectification can take on a woman, on women. Jessica Valenti, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I want to ask what stands out about this case, but I'm also just... You've been following this for so long. This statement was so incredible. We'll talk about the rape itself, but the statement is something in itself. It seemed to me almost like a marker of some change in the way that women, young women, think about their capacity to communicate, to demand, insist, be out front about what's happened.
Absolutely. I think when we look back, this letter is really going to mark a watershed moment in the way that we think about rape culture and the way that we talk about this issue. And I think it's two things. It's how far we've come in talking about victim blaming and talking about sexual assault. But it's also this moment, especially online, where women really are sharing their stories. And they feel like they have the space to share their stories in this way. But this letter in particular is so incredible. And I think there's a reason that it's touched so many people.
What do you think is the change in the way women, young women, are thinking that freed this woman to be so open? Now, she's to a point. She's anonymous. Who can blame her? But she's so very, very open. And to talk about this in such graphic detail, it is excruciating. Mm-hmm. But what exactly has gone on in the culture that's given her that freedom, power, permission? I don't know what you want to call it.
Sure. I mean, and listen, this is all prefaced by saying there is still an incredible amount of victim blaming. There still is stigma when it comes to talking about sexual assault, and women are still attacked and harassed and threatened for sharing their stories. But still, I think over the last 10 years, with the internet, with the explosion of social media, we've seen more and more women coming forward, young women especially leading the charge, sharing their stories, and really being unapologetic about them. And we're seeing an increase of support for them as well. You know, along with the harassment and along with the backlash, we're seeing this incredible support.
Does something in that frame of mind put the circumstances around rape on a different path? You've thought about these things for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you begin to call it out in this much detail, are we on the road to making this history or, you know, diminishing it or...
I hope so. You know, like I really, really do. I think the conversation around sexual assault has changed tremendously, right? Conversations about consent, yes means yes, victim blaming, these are all a part of the national conversation thanks to, you know, the work of feminist and anti-rape activists. And that's really been increased over the last few years.
We'll talk about this, but you say in Sex Object, your new book, the memoir, you want to claim the victimhood, like not run away from it or reject it, but claim it. Why? What?
I think that there can be a power or importance in talking about being a victim, right? I think for a long time...
She does in this statement.
And she does. I mean, she makes very clear, because we want to know the impact, right? Like, yes, there is also a power in you know, it's a common thing for victims of sexual assault to call themselves survivors, because they want to point to the fact that they have survived a horrible attack. And I think when it comes to, you know, that individual choice, people should call themselves whatever they want, obviously. But I do think that there is some power in laying claim to the word victim, to saying, this is something that happens. This is something that really negatively impacts people, whether you're a man or a woman, and then we need to talk about it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Stanford rape case, the outrage, the statement from the victim, the six-month jail sentence. Talking about men and women, victimhood, and feminism now with Jessica Valenti. Her new book is Sex Object. The whole country talking about the case, the woman behind the dumpster, the Stanford swimmer who assaulted her there, ultimately found by a couple of Swedish guys who saw him actively on top of this very still body. They called him out. They chased him down. Here's one of them, Carl Fredrik Arndt, talks about chasing after Brock Turner in an interview with CBS on Tuesday.
The guy stood up. Then we saw that she wasn't moving still. So we called him out on it. And guy ran away. My friend Peter chased after him.
Chased after him, caught him. The case, of course, went to trial. The judge heard about what it would cost him if he did serious time, gave him 6 months in jail. And there has been outrage about that. The statement by the woman was read in court, and it was read on CNN by Ashley Banfield on CNN's Legal View. Here she is with the victim, talks about the toll that the sexual assault has had on her life.
Your damage was concrete, stripped of titles, degrees, enrollment. My damage was internal, unseen. I carry it with me. You took away my worth, my privacy, my energy, my time, my safety, my intimacy, my confidence, my own voice until today. While you worry about your shattered reputation, I refrigerated spoons every night. So when I woke up and my eyes were puffy from crying, I would hold the spoons to my eyes to lessen the swelling so that I could see. I showed up an hour late for work every morning, excused myself to cry in the stairwells. The pain became so bad that I had to tell my boss that I was leaving. I cannot sleep alone at night without having a light on, like a five-year-old, because I have nightmares where, being touched, I cannot wake up. For 3 months, I went to bed at 6 o'clock in the morning.
From the statement of the woman in this case, we're talking with Jessica Valenti, feminist author of the new book, memoir, Sex Object. You can join us on this case and more. What's your verdict on the Stanford sentence? How do you understand all that happened here? Is that statement evidence of a new kind of feminism, a willingness to own it, to lay it all out, to tell her side of the story with strength in excruciating detail? Is Jessica Valenti right? Is it sometimes right to own victimhood, to see it, name it, declare it, and then fight the cause of it? I want to dive into the themes of your book. We've got a lot of callers here on this case as well. Chris in Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
First, I'd like to do a shout out to that victim for being so brave. I've been fighting this battle for 30 years, and I'm really interested in the way the discourse has changed radically. I think we're getting someplace after all that period of time. I was involved in a huge case that almost shut down the University of Wisconsin system, and we had a major Wisconsin legislative audit and a U.S. Department of Labor investigation and a shut down U.S. Department of Justice investigation. And I have been punished to the point of death for the past 30 years by the state for having done this. We have also had a whole series of people come down the pipeline in Madison, mostly football players, basketball players, hockey players. And the district attorney basically gives them a putch on the hand and says, go have a nice Rose Bowl.
Chris, what do you think has changed in the discourse? You say it's changed. Take a straight to that. What's changed, do you think?
Well, I was a feminist theory scholar at the university before my graduate school was yanked out from underneath me, and so I have a little bit of background in this. We could not have gotten through what they're having happen, for instance, at Berkeley. The faculty have come forward on behalf of the victims. There's a discussion about reimbursing people monetarily, which really doesn't help the situation. But there's also been a lot of dialogue about the number of young people that are being sexually assaulted in college by their peers, and fraternities are being shut down because of this kind of stuff. Let me just explain what didn't happen in Madison. We have had since women were allowed in the marching band, there has been this hazing thing going on where the women have been on the bus, been asked to perform sex acts on the bus in exchange for staying in the band, basically. And there was nothing done. They were suspended. There was an audit. The legislator audited them.
Chris, I don't know that story, but I hear the depth of your history in this, and I'm really take your note of the change in discourse here. And if you allow us, let me pick that up with Jessica Valenti here. And this brings it back to what you were saying. Something's changed. We're on new ground.
Absolutely. And I think what's been really so interesting, and the victim in this case does get to this in her statement, is a call to stop focusing on the achievements of a perpetrator, right? Calling him like an all-American swimmer, like this promising young college student, and focusing on the criminal actions of the perpetrator and centering those criminal actions in these conversations and the impact that they have.
You write about victimhood. You write about objectification. Mm-hmm. We'll look at that. And we've got the Stanford case right in front of us. People watching this and thinking, what was on his mind? How did he come to this place? Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Tom. Did the whining father not teach his son that the seconds of action of picking up a rock and hitting somebody in the head or holding somebody underwater and drowning them or picking up a gun and shooting somebody?
You mean when he said, don't let him be punished too much for 20 minutes of action, his unfortunate choice of words there?
Seconds of action.
Can kill.
Any second of action.
Yeah.
Can have consequences forever. And you have to teach your children what those consequences can be and that they make the choices.
Terry, I really appreciate your call. Let me get one more right on that subject from Linda in Boston. Linda, you're on with Jessica Valenti.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, as shocking as this whole thing is, as just the last caller just said, one of the most shocking aspects is the father's statements in his letter, and I fear that his big concern for his son is that his son would go to prison and get, heaven forbid, raped in prison. The irony of that is disgusting, and I just can't believe that the father doesn't understand. I think what we need to do in this terrible culture is have mandatory classes in high school for parents and kids with psychologists and sensitivity trainers spell it out. What is rape? What is consent? What is assault? What is your right to touch my body in any way without my consent? The alcohol is a whole other aspect of it that really needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that kind of conversation goes on. But let me ask you, Linda, if it was your child up there, you know, in the dock, facing maybe years in prison, would you not have stood up and tried to defend him, her?
Yes, but I think I certainly wouldn't want my child to be worse off, but clearly this young man, not a child, had no proper schooling on these issues in the first place, and you can hear that in the father's attitude. But yes, I understand his desire to save his son from any of what could happen to him, but he does deserve punishment. There's no question of that. And where are the girls? What about how the girls' parents feel?
Yeah, yeah.
And there was not a mention of the consequences for her life in this father's letter. The son's, the rapist's father's letter doesn't even address her, what her life now is and how she is changed for the rest of her life.
It was very striking. Linda, I appreciate your call. Jessica, what about the cultural mindset or the mm-hmm. family mindset? But I think it's wider than one family that produces that particular kind of tone-deaf defense.
Absolutely. And I think that the common theme that you're seeing both in the father's statement and in Brock Turner's statement is this shirking of responsibility and laying the responsibility at on the floor of drinking culture, party culture. And the victim got to this in her statement a bit. You know, plenty of people go to parties. The vast majority of them will not rape anyone,
mm-hmm.
right? And how does he sort of, use that excuse? He got caught running away. Was that part of party culture or was that because he knew that he was doing something wrong?
Kim in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Kim, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think, Kim?
When I was listening to this case the other day on the news, I only heard a part of the last part of it. And my first thought was, wow, that must have been a case from 15, 20 years ago, and they must be doing an article on how things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I listened to the rest of the article, I was absolutely disgusted and sick to my stomach that this is modern day. This isn't 15, 20 years ago where we're not paying attention. And I think what people need to understand, no matter what, the golden rule, but rape is rape. If someone is not wholeheartedly saying yes, then it is rape. It doesn't matter if they didn't say no. They have to say yes. And the fact that 20 minutes of this man and he's crying about how this has changed his life is nothing. This is what supports vigilante justice out in the communities when we don't make the right decision in the court system.
Kim, I appreciate your calling. Get one more right on that theme, and I'll take it to Jessica Leonard in New Orleans. Leonard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think we're approaching this entirely wrong.
Okay.
The rape was the rape. He needs to be punished. That's an understatement. But we're not extrapolating the issue of how did he get this sentence? Because that's the issue. How did the judge have the audacity to insult entire American people, the entire country, with this biased, offset association with his university experience and the kid's university experience that happened to parallel?
A judge who was reelected, yesterday, Leonard. I just heard for the first time in this hour.
In all fairness, he was unopposed. So if only one person voted for him, he would have won because he was unopposed. So that's still. I'm going to take that as a statement of the people
okay.
in this area.
Judge, this is
so he was reelected because one person could have reelected him.
Judge Aaron Persky, 54 years old. He's 54 years old. I'm reading here, a Stanford alum himself, Phi Beta Kappa grad. He was captain of the men's lacrosse team at Stanford. He's part of the college culture.
Yeah, he's one of the he's in the inner circle, and this kid is an up and coming inner circler at an Ivy League school. Stanford is the Harvard of the West Coast.
Sure. Leonard, I appreciate your call. Jessica Valenti, here's another cultural question then. What is it in this judge's circle, in the realm of jurisprudence, that would lead him to that kind of thinking?
You know, I think that, again, in our culture, in a culture that is a rape culture, I think people tend to empathize with the perpetrator more than they do the victim. And I also think that both Kim and Leonard got at something very important. One is how far we still have to go that the judge could say something like, he's giving him a short jail time because it might have a severe impact on him. But also, the function of white privilege in this case, and the fact that this was a young white man
mm-hmm.
going to a very prestigious college,
mm-hmm.
Who was an athlete, that all also functions to help him get a lesser sentence and to have people empathize with him.
Your new book is Sex Object. What do you mean when you say our culture is a rape culture, Jessica?
You know, rape culture doesn't mean that we condone rape through legislation, right? Obviously, we have policies, we have anti-rape legislation, but it does mean that through the culture, and we've seen through this case, through the criminal justice system, through the media and the way the media reports on rape, that we sort of make the world a little bit easier for rapists in a whole lot of different ways, whether it's focusing on their athletic prowess over their criminal activity or giving them, you know, short sentences.
You wrote a lot about sexual objectification. The book is called Sex Object. Is there a link in your mind between the prevalence of objectification of women and what you call a rape culture?
Absolutely. You know, objectification, sexual objectification in particular, is about dehumanizing people. And when you dehumanize someone, it becomes tremendously more easy to do violence to them and to do sexual violence to them. And I think when people are taught that women are not full human beings, but objects and things, and then it's a lot easier to excuse doing violence to them.
What is the difference? I mean, we are male and female. There is sexual attraction. What is the difference? Just spell it out, to be very plain, between objectification and appreciation.
Sure. I think that you can appreciate someone and sexually appreciate them and look at them in a way that you desire them. I think that's all wonderful, and a lot of us really like being looked at that way. I think what's important is that you're seeing, you know, them as a person and a human being and not a collection of body parts.
Which might make it easier to rape.
To hurt people, yeah.
Mark, in Miami, Florida, you're on with Jessica Valenti.
Hi, Ted. I wanted to add a comment from my own life experiences to this that goes to the cultural aspect of it. First and foremost, I wanted to say if she was my daughter, I would both be extraordinarily proud of her now, but also probably in jail. But that said...
You mean you'd want to do harm to someone. Okay, yeah.
You wouldn't have made it to the court.
Let's use the judicial system. Otherwise, where do we go? But okay, what do you think, Mark?
So let me move on to the culture aspect. In my experience, I grew up in a family with a very strong mother and woman, unequal, in fact, but in a culture where that is not the case, a very machista culture where the opposite is the case. And even though my home life was the correct way, in my opinion, it still took into my late 30s before I really started to see women in the way that I believe they should be seen, as just another human being, not an object. I mean, that to me is amazing, that our culture is so strong that for a person like me that grew up in that home, it still overpowered the teachings that I saw by example. So what I want to say to parents and educators, it's not enough to give a good example. The influences of culture in the world around us and the life around us are so strong that you have to be more active about it. Fathers and mothers need to talk to their sons and daughters specifically about this. Educators have to talk about it. I don't know if it needs to be required curriculum, but an effort needs to be made, because I look back at my concepts of womanhood growing up, and I'm ashamed. I'm frankly ashamed that it took me having a daughter to really get a perspective on that.
Mark, I so appreciate your call. Thank you very much in Miami. I mean, Jessica, what drives it?
I mean, it is the fact that we live in a sexist culture still. And it's so heartening to hear Mark's statement. And I think that a lot of men feel that way, you know, where they wish they would have had maybe a little bit more of a proactive teaching as they were growing up. And I think he makes a really important point, is that, you know, we can fight back against this. This is not inevitable, right? And sexual assault is not inevitable. Harassment is not inevitable. If we start talking about this more and more, and I think the victim statement has really done this in an incredible way, we have the ability to do that proactive teaching.
But it's not something that happens without a conscious effort. It seems to roll on very easily. There are moments when it's kind of a full stop, or at least a moment to pause and look at it. In her new memoir, Sex Object, Jessica Valenti writes about the impact of a lifetime of objectification on herself, on American women. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this time about the Stanford rape case, the outrage, the statement, the 6-month sentence about men and women Victimhood, and Feminism Now with Jessica Valenti. Her new book is Sex Object. It's a memoir. She tells of how objectification has played out in her own life, by extension in the lives of many, many others. Writes about owning victimhood sometimes. It seems in a way that this young woman in California has done that with her excruciating but eloquent statement about the cost of what unfolded behind the dumpster there. She's with me in the studio. You can join us as well. How do you see this case? How do you see where we stand now, where women stand now? Ironic, this comes against, well, these remarks from just last night by Hillary Clinton, the first to become the, what, presumptive nominee of a major political party in America, a milestone, she said last night.
Thanks to you, we've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee.
On the one hand, you've got that. On the other hand, you've got this case. Lots of people writing to us. Rhea says online, alcohol does not pardon you from committing a crime. If I get drunk and rob a bank, am I guilty of theft? Of course. Donnie writes on Facebook, it's sad the double standard for the affluent in this country. A black or Hispanic from the ghetto would have automatically received 17 years instead of 6 months. Fabulous Redhead says, pro tip, consensual sexual encounters don't typically take place with unconscious women, nor in the dirt behind a dumpster, nor do they involve getting pine needles and dirt in a woman's vagina, and don't typically end up with a woman in the emergency room with significant vaginal trauma. But Linda writes, well, the acts of the young man were completely wrong. Where is the responsibility of the young woman who got so drunk she didn't know what happened? What do you say to that, Jessica?
I'd say there's zero responsibility. You know, the responsibility lies with the perpetrator not to attack someone. As the victim said, it's not illegal to get blackout drunk. It is illegal to sexually violate someone.
Beth in Newport, Rhode Island. Beth, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jessica. I wanted to say that I fully support Emily Doe, and that is how the survivor is being identified in the media. And I do want to say that I agree with the fact that no one consents to sex behind a dumpster. The Turner family has a daughter. Is the father sharing a ribeye steak with the daughter? I'm very concerned about that daughter. And I also wanted to say that the father's remarks just send a pervasive message across the country that this is considered acceptable behavior. 20 minutes of action. How can he make a statement like that about this young woman and sit and break bread with his own daughter? I do not understand that. And if we want to correct the problem, my suggestion would be train these young men to view the victim as their mother. Would they do this to their mother? And I'm just going to take the remarks off the air. Thank you so much.
Beth, I appreciate your call. Jessica, in your book, Sex Object, you write about, would they do it to their mother? Well, you write about objectification sort of coming down through the generations in your own family, your grandmother, your mm-hmm. mother, down to your own experience.
Yeah, I do. I write about the sexual violence in my family history and generationally. And my concern for my daughter, I have a 5-year-old daughter, and I think about her a lot. And these issues have become a lot more urgent in my mind in thinking about her and what I'm going to tell her about the world that we live in and the way that the world treats women. And we don't have the language for that yet. You know, like we do have the language when we talk about survivors of rape. We have the language around specific incidents. We don't have the language for what it means to live in a culture that hates women and the cumulative impact of living in that culture.
Carlin in Portland, Maine. Carlin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Jessica. I want to share that I think reading this really, really, really profound statement, what it reminded me of is the transformative power of shutting one's mouth and opening one's heart to others' experiences. And I think that that's something that's really missing. Everybody wants to offer their opinions and be part of the discourse when realizing that truly hearing and learning from the experiences and feelings of others is really, really powerful. And I think in any social justice movement, when it comes to men's violence against women, men need to
men need to really stop and listen, start listening to the things that women have been telling us for 1,000 or more years. And furthermore, when it gets to the extremity of a sexual assault, that's when it's too late. We need to be listening to the kinds of things that women are trying to tell us about that are setting building the foundation, creating the environment where these beliefs can change into actions and become sexual assault. We need to learn what it takes far before that ever happens.
Carlin, we've got it, and I appreciate your call on that. I mean, this young woman with her extensive statement is really helping a lot of people to do that. One more right here. Thank you, Carlin. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Susan, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jessica. Thank you both so much for putting this on today. Just a quick background. I'm a white mom. I have an adopted son who's black, who was conceived out of rape, a sexual assault, and a white daughter who I gave birth to. And just thinking, and I myself am a victim of a very similar sexual assault to the woman in this case, and so many women that I know have experienced something very similar to this. Nothing that went to trial, but it just seems like it's kind of this common accepted thing that happens on college campuses. And I think what I wanted to say was I'm so glad you're doing this show today, that because even though I have these two kids and we have a black president and we have for the first time our, you know, the first female presidential nominee, it's great, these things that my kids can aspire to, but I just am so, I feel so, my heart feels so heavy today about how am I going to teach my kids that there's still such rampant racism and misogyny in our country. And the last thing I'll say, too, is I believe that the two men that stopped this or intervened in this incident were
two young Swedish guys. Yes.
I have to say, this sounds awful, but I'm glad that they weren't American, because part of me wonders if young American men would have intervened in this. So I'm very grateful you guys are doing this show today. I feel like we have a big task ahead of us, and I just feel so loaded with emotion with my own situation. So thank you guys so much for doing the show.
Thank you, Susan, for calling from Pittsburgh. I mean, there's Carlin who says men have to listen and take this on board and change the way they think. And Susan, you know, out of Pittsburgh, worried from her own experience, others that she knows, this is real. This goes on. How do you get to that change? Our caller Mark in Miami said, it took me until I was 40 to get away from objectifying. And if that's the culture you're in and it's accepted, I've been writing about and talking about this for many years, and it's not as though men have responded by saying, oh, excuse me, Jessica, I had no idea. I mean, at the back of this book, you include responses, online responses, most of them, I guess, from men responding to your writing about feminism. And I mean, they're just brutal. I mean, they're terrible. You know, I mean, here's someone who says, get back in the kitchen and make me dinner, bitch. Tiny brained woman, why do we ever let them think they were someone? So I think you need to be gagged. You know, I hope you perish in a gasoline explosion induced car crash. This is not exactly open hearts and minds.
No, there's still a tremendous amount of misogyny, and that's especially true online, where people sort of have anonymity to protect them from social consequences. But I do want to say that despite the level of harassment, and I really hear Susan when she says, you know, her heart feels heavy, I do think we're in this incredible feminist moment. And I think the reaction to this woman's letter goes to show that people really are ready for a change, that people want something different for their sons and for their daughters. And that makes me feel incredibly optimistic.
That people want something different.
I think they do.
Do you think women and men, for that matter, have found a way of articulating the straight and narrow here? I mean, and how does it stand up against the gusher of images that surround us all the time?
I don't think that we've found the perfect right answer. I think it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of work. And people have been working for decades on this issue. But I think the fact that women are telling their stories, and, you know, this is part of the reason that I wanted to put the book out now, it feels like this watershed moment when it comes to feminism, when it comes to conversations around sexual violence, where perhaps people are ready to hear it.
Listeners, you can read the entire letter from the victim of this assault at Stanford at our website, onpointradio.org. Carol in New Haven, Connecticut. Carol, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. I know that people are very much up in arms, and I don't blame them, mm-hmm. that he didn't get jail time.
He did, six months jail time. People are saying he should have had more, many people. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to tell you where he's going to suffer. I had a son 30 years ago who committed a sexual assault, and he was put on the Internet for 30 years.
On the sexual, the sexual predator list?
And from the minute that he came out, he was put on the net. And the suffering has extended to the family, mother, father, aunt, uncles, everybody in the community. People will look you up if they move into the neighborhood. And even though it's 30 years ago, they don't let their children play with our children because the father is on the Internet. And the suffering, they supposedly care about the children. Well, the children suffer horribly. And so do so many innocent people that are caught up that have done nothing wrong. So this man, he will suffer, and his family will suffer, and it'll go on for the rest of his life. And unfortunately, this may not sound good, but if you read incidences, violence is violence. And I keep up mm-hmm. with things that happen, very much so.
Carol, may I ask you, Carol, and this was your son, it was 30 years ago, it's a long time, and you say that the family, he and the family still suffer from it. When you think back on it, you've had too much time to do that now. What do you think went wrong? We're trying to imagine why these things happen. Why do you think your son, and I understand how painful this is, but why do you think he went down that road of sexual assault?
And he thought that it's a long story. It was an older woman he used to drink with, so it doesn't matter how it happened. It happened. The thing is that he got put on. Many of them today are put on for life, and there is really no review. And also, it's perpetuated the thinking that once a sex offender, always a sex offender.
Yeah.
And you hear it over and over and over. And after a while, perhaps perhaps it's true. Perhaps it isn't. If it is, then once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. That doesn't mean you will act on it. And he has not acted on anything in 30 years. In fact, how he gets through, I don't know.
Carol, I really appreciate your call. I mean, Jessica, that's a lot of suffering, too. And I don't want to get into the comparative suffering business here, but it's clearly, Carol's clearly right that whatever her son's sentence was, he and the family have paid for a long time.
Of course, and I feel for a lot of empathy for Carol and her suffering, and of course the conversation about the effectiveness of the sex offender registry is a very big one that I won't try to get into mm-hmm. here. But again, I think that the most important thing that's come out of this conversation is the way that we need to focus on perpetrators' behavior and the criminal actions and the impact that has on women and women's lives.
Speak to what you would say to young women, speak to what you would say to young men to try and put us on different ground here. You describe a lot of life experiences mm-hmm. in your memoir, Sex Object. It's compelling. Out of that learning, and when everybody agrees, this is not an aspect of our culture that we want to roll forward. What do you say to young men? Say to young women.
I think I have the same message for young women and for young men, and that's just to see each other as full human beings and to empathize with each other. And when it comes to cases like this, to listen to the victims, to listen to women's experiences, and to listen to what they're telling you.
Beth in Boston. Beth, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jessica. I just wanted to bring up that only about 3% of people who perform rapes and other sexual assaults will ever even get convicted and see any prison time. I think we're all right to be angry that this young man will only spend 3 to 6 months in prison, but what about the people who never even make it to trial by the thousands? Thanks. I'll take comments off air.
Thank you, Beth. Jessica, You're nodding along with Beth as she speaks right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. We know that only 3% of rapists will see jail time. And I think sort of the bigger conversation that we need to get at also is the why the criminal justice system does fail us on so many counts when it comes to sexual violence, and why so many victims are really hesitant to go through the criminal justice system because of it.
Do you see the Stanford case as an anomaly?
No, the Stanford case is not an anomaly at all. I mean, I think that it's an anomaly in terms of the attention that it is getting, certainly. But this, unfortunately, is a very, very common story, certainly at college campuses.
Well, here we are, people really with a chance to dig into it with this incredible statement. To the extent that all these years of talking about feminism and empowerment of women and being more straightforward gave that young woman, the victim in this case, the strength, the frame of mind to stand up and tell her story in this way, we've got to take our hats off to a lot of work that's been done over a long time. Yours within that work, Jessica.
I certainly hope that part of the reason that this victim was able to come forward is because of the groundwork that was laid by feminists online and often anti-rape activists. But I think at the end of the day, all of the credit really goes to her.
Jessica Valenti tells her own story in her new memoir, Sex Object, just out, and pretty good read. Check it out. She's a daily columnist for The Guardian U.S., founder of Feministing.com. You can link to her recent column at our website, onpointradio.org. Jessica Valenti, thank you very much for coming in today. Thanks. It's really a good moment to have you in our circle. Thanks. Jessica Valenti. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us today.